And joining us now is Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. He's the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, The University in Change, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex, Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, and his latest, America's Education Deficit and the War on Youth, Reform Beyond Electoral Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Oh, it's good to be here.
And I've been trying to cover the crisis in education, in particular student debt, which has reached almost a par with household mortgage debt, if not the first biggest debt in the country, certainly the second. And you've described this, or a friend of yours has described this generation, this indentured generation, as zero generation, zero job, zero hope, zero possibilities, zero employment. Is it as bleak as that?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that what we've lost in talking about young people are two things. We've lost any sense of the relationship that we have or obligation that we have to young people vis-a-vis what was once called the social contract. And so they're no longer an object of long-term investments. They're now actually the object, in many cases, of either oppressive modes of containment, pedagogies of repression, or they're subject to what we call a debt war that really sort of not only steals the future away from them, but it just completely stifles any sense of what we might call the radical imagination. I mean, if any element of our society should harbor the potential for being able to imagine something different, more democratic, more that reeks of hope and generosity and compassion, it's young people. And we're actually eliminating the conditions for many of them that even make that possible.
Well, I've read reports from economists saying that the indenturement of students with student debt and saddling them with debt for life, which, by the way, the Department of Education makes money out of student debt, a considerable amount of money. And recently, the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has basically taken the policing of student loans away from the Department of Education because of their abuse of students. So not only are these students being indentured, the debt collectors from the government, which forbids them from going into bankruptcy, are harassing them.
Well, I've actually read where, and maybe this is the implication, that they're contracting out these kinds of services to debt collection agencies that are actually ruthless,
right,
in their willingness to pursue young people who basically don't have the money to pay back loans that they shouldn't be paying back in the first place. And I think that, you know, what we're going to see in the future, given the kind of casino capitalism that's now at work in the United States and in some other countries under the name of austerity measures, what we're going to see is the rise of debtor prisons. I mean, that's next. I mean, a lot of these debt collectors now work very closely with attorney generals and law enforcement people and legal people who basically are bringing these kids into court and putting them in jail. I mean, trying to actually imprison them as a result of their defaulting on these debts. I mean, this is just, can you imagine? I mean, we put a generation of young people in jail because they're paying for something that should be free, while these people in Wall Street and the hedge fund managers and the people who have put the country into ruin since 2007 while benefiting off the misery and the suffering of other people actually get celebrated and go free.
Well, I was going to mention what the economists are saying, though, in terms of how this is depressing the economy, because normally before we had this indentured generation, which has just been happening gradually, but it's increased dramatically in the last few decades, normally these young people would be consuming. They'd be buying houses and refrigerators and cars instead of paying off their student loans, which is depressing this economy, which, you know, like it or not, unfortunately, 70% of our economy depends upon consumption. So, you know, I recall the old reactionary Henry Ford saying that, you know, you got to pay your workers enough to buy your product. So I don't understand the lack of logic here in terms of this new capitalism that you refer to as casino capitalism. Is it?
No, I think there is a logic. And I think what the logic is, the logic points to a very specific set, new set of what we might call political social relations, in that power now floats. You know, it's no longer attached to nation states. So what you have is you have this global ruling elite who doesn't concern, really not concerned about political concessions to labor, to students, or to anybody else. And I'm not so sure they're even concerned about consumerism fueling the economy. I mean, these are people who trade in simply in money for money. I mean, this is how they make their money now. I mean, they don't care about investing. They just care about selling off things and, you know, creating paper trails of money. And so I don't think that you really have the concern that we've had in the past when the economy was not financialized in the way it is today. These people are ruthless. I mean, they really don't have a major concern about the old Fordist economy where there were political concessions made to workers, where you had to be concerned about the fact that 75% of the society is being driven by consumerism. These new financial elite are really outside in some ways of the boundaries of those considerations. And even if the United States crumbled and failed, they'd move onward. I mean, believe me, there is no longer any allegiance to those kinds of considerations.
But obviously, at the end of the day, you cannot have a viable economy if you're consistently and relentlessly and ruthlessly extracting wealth and not creating wealth.
Well, ask them about that. I guess that's the important question, right?
Right.
I mean, if you want an economy that somehow works, even according to a liberal market logic, then clearly wealth has to go back into the economy. But I must tell you, Ian, everything that I read about this group of hedge fund crooks, financiers, and the financial elite and the bankers, they just seem oblivious to that. I mean, they seem to be concerned not about the long-term future and stability of an economic system, one in which they would greatly benefit. They're really concerned about short-term gains, as quick as possible, regardless of the misery, regardless of the suffering, and regardless of the consequences.
Again,
that's why it's called casino capitalism. The house always wins, and everybody else loses.
Again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, who is the writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. He is the author of Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, and his latest book is America's Education Deficit and the War on Youth, Reform Beyond Electoral Politics. And you were recently on Bill Moyers, Henry, and he really seized on your book, Zombie Politics and the Culture of in the Age of Casino Capitalism. So tell me, what do you mean by zombie politics?
Well, I mean, it's a kind of metaphor that basically speaks to the fact that we now have people who rule the country who love death-dealing institutions. And in many ways, you know, they love, you know, and rarely criticize, you know, bloated military budgets, the rise of the punishing state, the massive amounts of inequality. These are the walking dead. And the metaphor basically has a double meaning. I mean, at one level, it suggests people who are really heavily invested in what I call the organization and production of violence and what we might call realms of social and civil death. That's one. That's the higher register of meaning, metaphorically. The other side of that meaning is that there are a lot of people who are like the walking dead, in that their lives are so organized around barely surviving that they barely have the opportunity to enact any sense of critical engagement in agency. They're just getting by. I mean, 45 million people without health insurance, 47 million people on food stamps. I mean, you know the figures better than anyone. And I think that what we increasingly see is we see this zone of social and civil death sort of expanding across the country in ways that make the United States look like really, I mean, a third world country. I mean, a country that is basically mired in massive amounts of poverty and human suffering. But I think the zombie metaphor, where it becomes particularly apt around the question of casino capitalism, is that this is not a politics wedded to life. I mean, it's not a politics wedded to justice. It's not a politics wedded in any way to what we might call the realm of possibility or to the collective imagination. I mean, it really is a politics wedded to social death for most people. And in that sense, I think the zombie metaphor is quite apt. You know, I mean, these are blood-sucking, death-dealing politicians, anti-public intellectuals, lackeys who work in the university, who basically are on the take, you know, who do research for major corporations, even though they know that this research in the end probably ultimately harms people. I mean, there's a whole slew of them out there that have joined that culture. It's a culture that has nothing to do with democracy, and it has everything to do with the most authoritarian fundamentalisms that we can speak of as they begin to emerge in the 21st century.
So why not some pushback here? Why not a revolutionary pushback? Is there a problem with the American left?
No, I mean it's the great question, and it's the most important question. And I think that first there has to be some qualifications. And one qualification is that, look, power is never simply about domination. I mean, there are people pushing back. There are youth people. There are many young people, many youth organizations pushing back. There are people organized around local issues that are pushing back, whether it be the environment, whether it be questions of militarization, whether it be fracking, whether it be the oil line. I mean, we know this. I mean, they don't get the attention. In a celebrity culture, they're not part of the spectacle. So we don't see this. We know it's happening. The other side of this is there are two problems. One is while the emergence of these groups is very hopeful and speaks to some potential political changes, we really need to link these groups together. This fragmentation that has marked the left for so long, particularly since the end of the 1960s, really represents the death blow of the left. We need major organizations. While the Occupy movement was fine in terms of raising questions about what mattered, inequality and the 1% and all of that, I mean, it sputtered out because it can't produce national organizations, national infrastructures. You need visions matched by strategies, matched by organizational structures. So we need a third party. There's no question about that. The Republican and Democratic parties are simply, you know, two sides of the same coin. They're wedded to neoliberal ideologies. You know, it's the Clinton and Bush party. I mean, that's basically what it is. And I think that thirdly, we have to realize that the economic crisis in the United States has to be matched by a crisis of ideas. And while we're able to recognize the economic crisis, we haven't been able to recognize how important the crisis of ideas is. And that crisis basically speaks to why is it that neoliberalism in particular is able to mobilize the needs, the desires, and the values of people in ways in which they agree to forms of oppression that basically oppress them. You know, where is the left around education? Where is it around questions of consciousness? Where is it around the great struggle over ideas? You know, what does it mean to reclaim democracy, for instance, in the United States, in a way that talks about radical democracy and not just this nonsense that passes for democracy today with a two-party system that's basically bought by the bankers and the lobbyists?
Well, I understand, Henry Giroux, the detrimental effects of identity politics on the left, but I'm broadcasting from the Pacifica Network that's going bankrupt because it's moving away from traditional left-wing politics. And, of course, as you know, the media spectrum is entirely dominated by the right and by corporate power and right-wing influence. And this tiny little sliver on the left is extinguishing itself because it's gravitating towards conspiracy and quackery. And people, they think they're on the left, but they're actually, many of them are adherents of this right-wing nutcase, Alex Jones. So what's happening to political literacy in the country?
Oh, no, it's truly a crisis of major proportions. I mean, I think that when we confuse literacy with the kind of idiocy that passes for celebrity culture, then we know they have won. When they can set the agenda for what needs to be talked about and what needs to be taken seriously, when we have to sort of reclaim their language in order to feel that that's the only way that we can be relevant, that's truly a crisis of political literacy. But it's also a crisis of bravery. I mean, it's also a crisis of civic courage. I mean, it seems to me that if the left has anything that it can claim to over the course of the last 200 years, it's a sense of dignity and the willingness to speak out and to talk about issues intelligently in a way that mobilizes people. I mean, some of this is our own fault, as you well know. I mean, it seems to me the most important public intellectuals in the country today are people like you. You know, are people who are on public radio taking real issues, talking about them seriously, but doing it in a language that's accessible, without sacrificing theoretical and political rigor. That's the key. I mean, I think that as soon as we see, you know, political issues migrating to universities in ways in which they get completely caught up in these firewalls of academic jargon, and I'm not talking about the importance of theory. I'm talking about jargon. I'm talking about people who talk to each other, five other people, and believe somehow they're making a contribution. We've lost the notion and the meaning of public intellectual. We no longer know what it means. And yet it seems to me that the university, among other places, along with journalists, may be the only two places left, really, in the United States, where public intellectuals have an opportunity to really begin to, in some way, join with social movements, help to shape policy, speak in a language that's accessible, but more importantly, talk about issues that are simply left out of the conversation.
Again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University and the author of Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism and his latest book, America's Education Deficit and the War on Youth, Reform Beyond Electoral Politics. When you talk about celebrity culture, because I'm talking to you from across the street from Universal Studios here in Hollywood, which, you know, Hollywood and television basically propagate celebrity culture. They also propagate the culture of violence through gun worshipping. Every poster of every movie has somebody pointing a gun at you. And we also, as a society, we see what this deadly intersection between mental illness and easy access to firearms does on a regular basis with these recurring massacres that we don't seem to be able to do anything about politically. But in terms of celebrity culture, it sort of reminds you of the old Marxian phrase of the opiate of the masses. I was watching television, and you can't escape it, Henry. Since this movie star got killed driving a car too fast, the outpouring of working class people going to this shrine where the car exploded into flames and the press coverage of it, as though these people knew this guy. I mean, there's a
real... I mean, I think that, you know, I hear that, and I think to myself, you know, look, what kind of needs are being mobilized in people in ways that offer the swindle of fulfillment? I mean, what real needs are being activated here, although they end up in this silly, stupid sort of worship of celebrities that they don't even know, and then they're weeping as if, you know, it was their brother or sister that died. I mean, I think that, you know, we live in a culture in which not the real violence, symbolic violence that's being waged by Hollywood is one that says a couple of things to us. It says, one, we're alone. We're alone. That all problems that matter can only be solved by virtue of your own initiative and sense of individual responsibility. People are completely atomized. We have completely destroyed, for the most part, at least vis-a-vis Hollywood and the major cultural apparatuses, any sense of community. So people are just flocking anywhere where they can have some sense of attachment. Secondly, it seems to me that violence increasingly becomes the only force that is capable of mediating and addressing any kind of problem that we have. The United States is an entirely militarized society. And it's not only militarized in terms of the war machine that we've created that's larger than, you know, the next seven, you know, countries combined. It's militarized in terms of its culture. I mean, we've militarized the police. I mean, everywhere we turn, violence is like an electric current. It's like the only place left that can combine with pleasure to offer some sort of sense of intense gratification. That's just one step away from the worst kind of authoritarianism. And thirdly, it seems to me that the question of violence, beyond being symbolic, is a question of political economy. I mean, we have these massive, these massive organizations that have enormous amounts of wealth, that are so invested in these zombie-like machineries of death, that what it speaks to is the need for a revolution in the United States. I mean, you really need a peaceful, civil revolution. I mean, these sources of what we might call, again, the organization of the production of violence, they have to be dismantled. And we can only hope that the conditions increasingly are matched by a raise in collective consciousness and a sense of indignation and a push towards a collective imagination that allow people to be able to understand that instead of celebrity culture, we could have radical democracy. Instead of a joy in violence, we could have a joy in community. you know, instead of a sense of being alone, that there are problems that are systemic, that are beyond our reach, and that we can solve those problems if we change the system.
Well, Henry Giroux, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. He's the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, The University of Change, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex, Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, and his latest book, America's Education Deficit and the War on Youth, Reform Beyond Electoral Politics. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the suspension of aid to the Syrian rebels following the seizure of the Free Syrian Army warehouse full of weapons by Islamists.